If someone doesn't know about Socrates and they wake up tomorrow morning in this modern world with the mind of Socrates, what problem might that solve?
We are living through a kind of pandemic of ignorance and BS compared to ancient Athens. And he would say, you voluntarily subjected to yourselves to drinking from a veritable fire hose of BS. Socrates would say, rather than addressing your ignorance, you'd be motivated to be guided by ignorance. And so the Socratic method is meant to cure this kind of intellectual conceit called double ignorance.
We talked to our sales team about the Socratic method. How do you actually apply that and where would you start?
True wisdom isn't a bunch of opinions. True wisdom is an activity. It's a skill. It is the Socratic method itself. And then you're lying on your deathbed and you look back in your life and you think to yourself, if only I could get another few days extended of life, that's what I'd do. When you come face to face with your own mortality, you start to fundamentally question prevailing values of your society.
Donald Robertson, welcome to the show. So I've had you in my ears for the last few months. I've listened to a lot of your stuff, a lot of your podcast appearances. So I've tried to split this up into a few different areas. So I want to start off with Socrates.
Yeah.
Because I thought it would be top of mind. So if someone doesn't know about Socrates and they wake up tomorrow morning in this modern world with the mind of Socrates and they start thinking like him, what problem might that solve?
I think it would solve many problems. I'll give you a psychological answer, first of all. They'd have a higher degree of what psychologists call cognitive flexibility. So it's my belief that Socrates introduced a trademark method, right? We call it the Socratic method. He's known for asking questions in a particular way. It's the kind of origin, really, of the Western philosophical tradition. There were philosophers before Socrates, but we call those guys the pre-Socratics, right? Because Socrates marks a sort of watershed moment in the history of philosophy, and the introduction of the method of questioning that he used has had huge implications for the education philosophy in the West. But that method allows people to overcome a sort of rigidity in their thinking. In the ancient world, Socrates told everyone that was a big deal. He said the Socratic method was a therapy for the psyche, funnily enough. Psychotherapy existed in the ancient world. And like 100%, like literally, they had psychotherapy in the ancient world. A lot of people don't know that. And the big question would be, well, that's great. What does it cure? Like, what does the Socratic method cure? And Socrates said it cures something that we call double ignorance, right? That's worse than normal ignorance, right? Normal ignorance is, Socrates thought, not really that big a deal, right? If you don't know anything about space travel, or you don't know anything about medicine, or you don't know anything about shipbuilding, it's not that big a deal necessarily. And if you need to know and you realize that you don't know, you might be motivated to educate yourself or consult an expert, right? That's part of human life. However, if you falsely believed that you were an expert on medicine or shipbuilding or space travel, and when in reality you're not, that's a kind of intellectual arrogance or conceit that could get you into trouble. Because Socrates would say, rather than addressing your ignorance, you'd be motivated to be guided by ignorance. And so the Socratic method is meant to cure this kind of intellectual conceit called double ignorance. It's a little bit like the Dunning-Kruger phenomenon. Like Socrates was a bit ahead of the curve in recognizing that as a problem. Now, I don't know about you, but I feel that it's particularly relevant today. During the pandemic, I met a lot of people, a surprising number of people that were experts in epidemiology, like, and vaccines and stuff like that. I listened to many lectures on vaccines and epidemiology from people without any medical qualifications or training or knowledge, funnily enough. If you want to be lectured by people that have got zero knowledge or credentials, social media is the place to go. It's kind of full of that. The Socratic method is very timely in the sense that we've created a technology that massively exacerbates the problem that he was trying to address. And there's another problem that Socrates wanted to address. There are several, really. That was the main one. The other one that he sought to address was the development of rhetoric, which was really propelled into existence by democracy. So Athens is the birthplace of democracy. It's a great idea. So they have a kind of direct democracy where thousands of people meet on the Pnyx, this hillside next to the Acropolis. And people would say, I think we should invade this city, or like we should make agree peace with it. We should build more ships. You know, we should do this, we should do that. Like, and they'd have a little bit of a back and forth about it. Like, people would discuss the pros and cons of different things, and then they'd vote on it. And it worked pretty well as a system. However, there are flaws in that system. Like, the problem is if people start talking BS, right, basically. And that's exactly what happened. After the death of Pericles, who was the great Athenian statesman, who was the leader of Athens at the height of its power, he dropped dead one day from the plague, unfortunately. And then the demagogues moved in. Like, and so what they did, if somebody said, listen, I've got this great idea about building more ships, and this is, here are the pros and cons of doing it, the demagogues would say, so what? You're corrupt. And so's your mum. And so are all of your friends. And they'd call them names and ridicule them in front of the assembly. So the discourse degenerated into petty arguments and insults and sometimes bogus allegations of corruption, weaponizing the legal system. And so they had correctly identified some of the potential weaknesses in their nascent democratic system, and people came along who exploited those weaknesses to the hilt, to the absolute maximum that they could be exploited. It led to a massive rift between different political factions that grew and grew and grew until it culminated in a civil war, and Athens collapsed into a dictatorship called the 30 Tyrants, right? So we don't want to do that, right, in modern society. It's not a, it's a warning story, right? But today, in ancient Athens, you had to go to the Pnyx, or you had to get out of your, you had to put your sandals on, go out the house, walk five, you didn't have to go far, you maybe walk like 10 minutes or whatever, walk half an hour, and you'd go somewhere and you'd stand or you'd sit and you'd listen to a politician spewing BS and trying to manipulate you into, they try and make you angry, they try and make you frightened, they try and dangle a carrot in front of you and play on your greed to manipulate your basic characteristics in order to get you to vote for something that wasn't necessarily that great an idea or in your interests sometimes. But you'd have to leave your house, generally speaking, to do that, right? Socrates stepped out of a time machine and saw modern society. The first thing I think he'd comment on is, you guys don't even need to leave your house anymore in order to expose yourself to political rhetoric and propaganda. He'd be like, it started with the invention of the radio, newspapers, television, the internet. Now you carry around multiple electronic devices that invite propaganda and rhetoric into your lives 24/7. You lie in your bed in the morning drinking your coffee, listening to BS that's beamed directly into your eyes and brain by people suffering from double ignorance all over the internet, right? Socrates, in other words, would think that we are living through a kind of pandemic of ignorance and BS compared to ancient Athens. We're massively exposed to verbal manipulation, exploitation on a scale that would baffle ancient Athenians. And Socrates thought he'd developed a technique for helping us to protect ourselves against BS, the philosophical method. We call it dialectic or the Socratic method. It's a method for identifying mistakes in the assumptions that we're making in our thinking, for spotting contradictions in our thinking, and basically reflecting on the quality and logic of our thinking as a way of trying to counteract the baneful effects of verbal persuasion, sleight of hand, rhetoric, and so on. And he would say, you guys really need this more than ever before, because you've voluntarily subjected to yourselves to be drinking from a veritable fire hose of BS. Like, you, it's like the sophists, as the ancient Greeks called the experts on rhetoric, have invaded your homes. That's, I think that's one of the things that he would say.
So we talked to our, we've got a sales team of 18, Donald, and we talked to them about the Socratic method. But yeah. I don't know if you remember them, but I think it might have been in the year 2000. There was these books that went round that was like An Idiot's Guide to eBay or An Idiot's Guide to Google. So for anybody that's listening who's thinking, actually, I want to get better at the Socratic method, I want to be able to ask brilliant questions. How do you actually apply that, and where would you start?
Well, in some ways, it's a little bit tricky to explain the Socratic method, but funnily, so books have been written about it, trying to explain it. There's a really good book by Ward Farnsworth, who's a law professor and an expert on rhetoric, actually. But he's also an expert on Stoic philosophy and Socratic philosophy. It's called The Socratic Method, if I remember rightly, by Ward Farnsworth. It's a really good modern guide to the method. But actually, there's something missing from his book, if I remember rightly, which is, you know, although sometimes it's kind of hard to summarize the Socratic method, there is a passage in, we have dialogues, we have Socratic dialogues by Plato, about 37 of them. That's our main source for understanding Socrates. But less well known are the 40-odd dialogues that we have written by another of Socrates' students called Xenophon, who's an Athenian general that all survive today. And in one of those dialogues, in a book called The Memorabilia Socratis, everything I remember that Socrates said, like there's a little dialogue with a young guy called Euthydemus, who's probably like 15, 16, 17, something like that. And Socrates meets this dude. First thing he notices, he's got a lot of books, right? He's got a huge collection of books. Now, as a therapist, I read that and I thought, this guy seems familiar, right? He's what we call in the trade a self-help junkie, right? There are people today that psychologists and therapists meet that have got more books than the therapist or psychologists have on their bookshelf. People are inundated with self-help advice. And Socrates talks to this young guy, and he says that he admires his desire for self-improvement, but he also questions him and kind of quickly exposes that he doesn't really understand some of the basic concepts that he's employing. He doesn't really know what it is that he's trying to improve about his character. He needs help from something like the Socratic method. So Socrates teaches him a simplified version of it in that dialogue, and he uses a teaching aid to show it to him. He draws a little diagram, funnily enough. Not a lot of people know that. He literally draws a little diagram, probably on a wax tablet or something, and he makes two columns. Now, that jumps out the page at me, because I guarantee you, as we speak, somewhere in the world, multiple places in the world, there are multiple cognitive behavioral therapists drawing two columns on a flip chart right now and doing what we call the imaginatively titled two-column technique with clients in CBT. It's one of the most common cognitive therapy techniques. So that sometimes classicists and philosophers don't even notice these things, but as the therapist, certain things that Socrates does jump out, and you think, this is a thing that happens in therapy today that we use like very frequently. So he does a two-column technique with this young guy to show him the basic skills required for the Socratic method. And at the top of one column, he writes justice. The top of the other column, he writes injustice. So he says to this young guy, what's your main goal? And he says, I want to become a great statesman, so an expert on justice. I'm going to advise people about what's just and what's unjust, what's right and what's wrong before the assembly. And Socrates says, oh, sounds like you'd need to know what those words mean. And this young guy's like, yeah, obviously I know what they mean, Socrates. People always thought Socrates was asking dumb questions at first. And then quickly they'd find that they couldn't really answer his questions. They started to struggle, and they, you know, sometimes that was very enlightening for them, and sometimes they got quite annoyed about it. So Socrates said, well, could you explain what justice and injustice are? And the young guy said something kind of interesting. He said, well, I can give you lots of examples of injustice. That's really easy. Now, actually, it's the case that many people find it easier to define their values negatively, funnily enough. If you ask people, you know, what their core values are, like, they're often a bit vague about it, surprisingly vague about it. But if you ask them what the things that most annoy them about other people, it's pretty easy for them to rattle off a list. Like, everyone hates corruption in politicians, or at least that's the impression you get from social media, because people go on and on and on about it a lot. They hate Biden or Trump or whoever for being corrupt, blah, 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 blah. That suggests that they must really value integrity and honesty like the converse of the thing that they despise in other people, you'd think. It seems to imply that anyway. So Socrates says, okay, let's define injustice first of all. Can you give me some examples? And Euthydemus says, well, actually, it's Socrates that tends to suggest the Socratic method doesn't consist in formulaic questions. In fact, Socrates uses a sort of creative brainstorming process. That's what's tricky about it. It requires skill. So Socrates will come up with examples. He will say, what about lying and stealing and stuff like that? Are those examples of injustice? And Euthydemus says, yeah, of course they are. Obviously so. Right? And they list some other things as well. Now, that's the easy part, right? So Socrates says, I guess justice must be the opposite. Like avoiding lying and stealing would be just behavior, right? He says to Euthydemus, this is the interesting part. You're probably wondering why I drew a little thing with two columns in it. And Euthydemus says, like, I was asking myself that very question, Socrates. And Socrates says, I wanted to ask you, under what circumstances might, for example, lying be moved from the injustice column across to the justice column? Like, so the subtext here is that he's identified that this young man has an assumption about the nature of injustice, right? He's got a kind of definition of it. It consists of these examples, but he hasn't really reflected on it critically and questioned it himself. Like, he hasn't started to kind of look for possible exceptions to the generalization that he's making. So, yeah, lying. Euthydemus says, I don't know what you mean, Socrates. And Socrates says, well, suppose you're an elected general. The Athenians elected their generals. And you lied to the enemy during warfare. Would that be unjust? And Euthydemus says, well, come on, Socrates, that's kind of like an exception, isn't it? And Socrates says, suppose you're a parent and you concealed medicine in the food of a small child because it was the only way you could get them to take it for the benefit of their health. And Euthydemus is like, yeah, well, okay, that's lying of sort. But that's different, Socrates, right? It's different. And Socrates says, suppose your friend is suicidal and they ask you, where did you hide my dagger? Like, would it be unjust to lie to them, like, in order to protect them from harming themselves? And Euthydemus is like, okay, I see what you're driving at here, right? It was an overgeneralization to say that lying is a form of injustice. Maybe there are exceptions to that. Remember earlier I mentioned cognitive flexibility as one of the things that people derive. For the very nature of language encourages us to think in sweeping generalizations. And usually, you know, that's concealed in the assumptions that we make. We make assumptions about the basic concepts that we employ, our core values, right? And so Socrates wants people to stop, reflect on their assumptions, and begin looking for exceptions to them. So he'll usually ask people to define a value or a fundamental concept, and then he'll start trying to brainstorm possible exceptions to it. So typically he'll show them that their definition is too broad. Sometimes he'll also show them that the definition that they're using might be too narrow, actually. And in the process, he'll get people to keep refining their definition. Now, many people have complained that this sometimes results in chaos. Like, so people end up being more confused than they were at the beginning of the dialogue. Like, they come out of it feeling that they know less than they believed that they knew at the beginning of the dialogue. And some people don't like that, right? But other people do. Because Socrates was curing them of double ignorance. Like, they falsely believed that they knew what justice was when in fact they weren't really sure. And he's kind of exposing the fact that they don't really know some of the things that they're acting as if they do know, right? It's a kind of negative process. It takes away layers in order to liberate us and make us open to new learning, basically. But there's something else that's going on. There's a more fundamental mistake, I think, that people make. And this comes to, you know, what are the benefits of the Socratic method and why they're hard to quantify sometimes. We live in a society, the same as in ancient Athens, where people expect things to be simpler sometimes than they actually are. And so people expect wisdom. People think you can purchase wisdom like you could go to the supermarket or the greengrocers and buy a bag of onions, right? So in ancient Athens, you would go and pay money to listen to a sophist. They deliver a lecture about the nature of justice. They teach you some maxims about justice that you'd memorize, and then you go and repeat that. Ancient Athens in Socrates' time was full of people parroting stuff that they'd heard from professional wise men or experts. It got a bit frustrating for him. He thought, I need to go and find the original guy that came up with this, because everyone else is just repeating what they've heard in his speeches. That's exactly the same as today. People go on YouTube and they watch a video by Jordan Peterson or Joe Rogan or whoever it is, and then they just repeat the stuff that they've heard on the internet without really thinking it through or questioning it. They do, the difference, for example, when people watch a lot of videos about philosophy and someone actually doing a degree in philosophy, is they're not sitting any exams. Like, they're not engaging in debate, like attending seminars, symposiums, tutorials. So there's no pushback, like, against the opinions that they've acquired passively online by listening to lectures or reading essays or whatever, right? So for Socrates, you can't acquire wisdom passively just by memorizing things. You need, it's more like a cognitive skill. It's a dynamic process, right? True wisdom isn't a bunch of opinions. True wisdom is an activity. Like, it's a skill. It is the Socratic method itself. Basically, it's knowing how to question things and identify exceptions. And even if at the end of it you think, to be honest, I'm not really sure how I'd define justice, you've nevertheless figured out the limits of what you previously assumed and possible exceptions to it. So funnily enough, you've got a better understanding if you know that perhaps lying to an enemy in warfare, deceiving a small child in order to give them medicine, like not telling your friend where you've hidden a dagger, might be just in some circumstances. Even if it's not conclusive, you know, this kind of fuzziness is actually a bit closer to the truth than the kind of rigid, like, presupposition that you had before. To highlight the relevance of this, and I don't mean this to just like pick on someone, but as it happens, that very example, which is the one that Socrates uses, is one of the 12 rules of life in the best-selling self-improvement book of the past few years by Jordan Peterson. So, you know, even today, like, the best-selling books on self-improvement often follow this kind of strategy of teaching people generalized maxims or rules. And Socrates thought that very approach was kind of flawed. You know, these rules or coping strategies or whatever, these generic pieces of advice are all that you tend to get from videos and books. But they work quite well in some situations, but not necessarily in others, right? You know, and real wisdom would consist in being adaptive, like being flexible in your thinking. There's a large body of research today that shows that no single coping strategy works across the board in dealing with stress and developing emotional resilience, right? Some coping strategies are generally better than others, like relaxation techniques, mindfulness, you know, cognitive coping statements, or, you know, cognitive restructuring, like questioning yourself and things like that. All these different techniques that people can use to cope with stress have their pros and cons. But the research consistently shows that the people that are most resilient and cope best with stress have a trait that psychologists call not cognitive flexibility, but coping flexibility, although they're two related things. You know, someone who's good at coping with stress would think, you know, my mindfulness techniques work quite well, but maybe a different technique would work better in this situation. Or maybe mindfulness works in the dentist, but if I want to use it for public speaking, I'd need to kind of modify the technique a little bit, right? Rather than just kind of learning something and then applying it rigidly across the board, which is what we all tend to do when we just soak up information passively from books and videos. So Socrates, I think, is, you know, really wants to challenge this sort of passivity in our thinking. The Socratic method, it's a little bit hard to quantify it for us. It can seem a little bit evasive, but it's really about putting our assumptions into words. Socrates wanted us to be able to, you know, some people might even not be able to say what how they would define wisdom or how they would define their core values. But encouraging ourselves to reflect on that and articulate it concisely in words, and then question whether there might be exceptions to that. There's other strategies that Socrates uses, but that's the basic method. And that little two-column diagram is one way of doing it. Basically, it's asking yourself, okay, these are all examples of wisdom, for instance, or justice, or in other contraries, you know, under what situations or circumstances might I move them across into the opposing column. There's other ways we can use that strategy in cognitive therapy that are kind of similar and also help people to develop cognitive flexibility. So say somebody, you know, you almost all clients in therapy suffer from rigidly rigid core beliefs or rigid assumptions, right? So someone might think, for example, you know, they might have a core belief if they're depressed that I'm worthless, I'm useless, you know, I'm stupid or something like that. And a cognitive therapist might draw two columns and say, what evidence is there that you're basing that on? And what evidence is there against it? And the evidence that you're basing it on, could that possibly be interpreted in a different way anyway? Is it actually good evidence? So just this process of getting people to think about things in a more nuanced way, to break things down. When I teach clients coping techniques, like the self-help techniques that you see online, like if it's mindfulness or whatever, what I'll often do is then a second step, which I think is really important, which is to draw two columns and maybe say, what are the one-headed pros and the other cons? What are the pros and cons of mindfulness? You know, well, mindfulness might make me able to observe my thoughts in a more detached way. But in social situations, I guess it could also make me more self-conscious if I'm not careful. And that might be a bad thing. So getting people to kind of reflect on the pros and cons of different techniques helps them then to adapt those techniques and to apply them more intelligently. It's like a step that's missing often in the learning of self-improvement or self-help.
I love that, forcing the idea of going back to white belt thinking and not seeing things as binary as well.
Yeah,
exactly. Another man you've written a lot about is Marcus Aurelius.
And yeah,
me and Jack, like I'm sure all people who stumbled across Marcus Aurelius during the pandemic, love him. And everything that you read about him subsequently, it seems to be more and more impressive.
Yeah.
But as a man who's gone even deeper, what do you think are the most impressive things about Marcus Aurelius and the way his life turned out?
Well, I wrote three books in a row about Marcus Aurelius, as well as some book chapters, and I wrote an introduction to an edition of his Meditations as well. So at one point I was like really kind of getting to the point where I think I need to move on and write about someone else. That's why I wrote a book on Socrates in part. I thought, I can't just keep writing books about Marcus Aurelius, come on. The reason I started writing about him, incidentally, was I wanted to write a book on Stoicism where we would draw on the example of an actual Stoic. There are multiple reasons for that, but I just wanted to mention that there are common misconceptions about Stoicism, and there are ways that we can address them head on, but often you can kind of address them in a soft or indirect way just by looking at examples of actual real Stoics, right? So sometimes people think that Stoicism means being unemotional or cold-hearted. That's a misconception of the philosophy. But if you look at Marcus Aurelius, he wasn't like that. So just looking at the actual representative of the philosophy and how he lived his life helps to kind of refute this misconception. Or people think that Stoicism is about accepting stuff, like amor fati, like accepting your fate, and that would make people passive in the face of injustice. And you go, oh, like Marcus Aurelius, who famously just sat around and did nothing and was really fun. No, he was a workaholic, if anything. Like, he was kind of obsessed with protecting the empire, and, you know, he really, you know, dedicated his life to justice and ruling wisely. So, you know, that should highlight the fact that these are misconceptions of Stoicism. So I wrote a book about Marcus Aurelius about 5 years ago called How to Think Like a Roman Emperor that kind of caught fire unexpectedly. I'd written a bunch of books prior to that, but that was the first book that I wrote that became a bestseller, and it sold over a quarter of a million copies now, and it's been translated into over 20 languages, including Greek, weirdly. The things that are kind of surprising about Marcus Aurelius are impressive about him. I mean, Cassius Dio, one of the historians that describes Marcus Aurelius' life, says Marcus Aurelius faced so many problems, it was almost like the gods were testing his stoicism, you know. And that's one of the interesting things about it. Like, he had a very challenging life. He doesn't seem to have really wanted to become emperor. I think there are reasons for that. That might surprise some people. It doesn't really surprise me, because Marcus Aurelius was the adoptive grandson of Hadrian, who is often described as one of the good emperors because his reign was very successful. But that's different from saying he was a nice person. Like, Hadrian was a very troubled individual. Towards the end of his life, when Marcus Aurelius mainly knew him, Hadrian went crazy, really, and kept trying to kill himself and other people. Like, he had political purges where he kept trying to execute or was imprisoning many senators and political opponents. He was physically kind of really in a bad condition in terms of his health, and created this huge opulent palace that he almost a bit, he reminds me a little bit like Colonel Kurtz, like in Apocalypse Now. Like, he holed himself up outside Rome in this big, massive complex that he created. And Marcus Aurelius had to go and live with him there for the last, I think it was like last 4 months or last 6 months of his life, when Marcus was 16, 17, if I remember rightly. And he didn't want to go. Like, it freaked him out a bit, I think. And so Marcus thought, I don't want to be like Hadrian. Like, this guy's an absolute train wreck, basically, it seems to me. And so maybe one thing that would be impressive about Marcus Aurelius is he did go on to become emperor. He kind of was forced into the position. And I think he threw himself into Stoic philosophy from a very early age, an exceptionally early age, because he was thrust into the position of being a leader. And he just witnessed a catastrophically bad example of leadership. And so he clutched on, like clutching onto a straw, he grabbed onto Stoicism as a way of avoiding becoming like Hadrian.
I was going to say...
That impresses me about him.
I was going to say then, well, one of the things that me and Marcus Aurelius have in common, but I actually don't think... I was thinking that sentence in my head and I thought, I can't even say that as a fact. But one of the things that I like, that I know that Marcus Aurelius talks about, is death. Okay, so I sign off all my LinkedIn posts with "Remember, you must die,"
especially at Christmas.
Yeah, exactly.
People love talking about death for some reason. Particularly at Christmas, people love talking, contemplating their own mortality. But we're just kind of coming out of the Christmas period now. I think people are still contemplating their own mortality. I'm not even joking. like have you seen the Muppets Christmas Carol? Right. Mm. Dickens' Christmas Carol is all about contemplating your own mortality. Ebenezer Scrooge is taken into the future and sees his own grave. Like, it's one of the best examples in literature. And like, everybody, families all around the world gather around every Christmas and watch it in the Muppets.
So what's your take on it? What's your, from all your learnings and kind of studying, what's your feeling towards it? What did the Stoics absolutely nail? Maybe what did they get wrong when it came to approaching death?
Contemplating death and overcoming death anxiety is a hot topic in modern psychology, incidentally, in social psychology. There's a lot of good research and a lot of interest in the potential implications of death anxiety and the benefits of death contemplation. Death contemplation is something that's very prominent in existential philosophy, particularly in Heidegger. Like, so it was kind of a trendy thing in academic philosophy in the 20th century. And that was how I first came across the idea, was by reading Heidegger. And then, but in ancient philosophy, it was extremely common. It's a big thing in other religious and philosophical traditions, such as Buddhism, for example. You know, it's almost as if modern man is unusual in the fact that he doesn't explicitly embrace this practice of contemplating his own mortality. You know, like, throughout history, people have thought there's something important about this. The truth is that this is how I'll explain it to you. It seems to me this is the life in a nutshell, right? When you're born, you can't speak English, but you can move your arms and legs after a while. And so you start to kind of try and figure out what it is you're meant to be doing. So initially, your only real way of doing that is instinct and copying what other people around you are doing, like monkey see, monkey do. So toddlers emulate what they see. And then over time, you start to develop languages, self-awareness, and reflection. Like, and the capacity to question the behavior of other people around you and the values that are implicit in it. Now, the problem is, if you look around you, you would naturally, if you were an alien and you looked at the human race, I think you would naturally assume they're obsessed with money, like, and reputation. Like, they're always like trying to impress people and win arguments and stuff like that. And they're obsessed with acquiring property, even risking their lives to do it. So those are the values. You know, it's puzzling why throughout the ages have we always reverted back to this kind of materialism and kind of egotism in our philosophy of life. I think there are innate reasons why we keep generation after generation gravitating back to it. But if you stop to reflect on it deeply enough, you might think maybe money isn't the answer, you know, and maybe fame and status aren't really the answer. Maybe there's other stuff that's more fundamental in life, like enlightenment, wisdom, insight, understanding, like integrity and all that kind of stuff, and strength of character, right? You might start to think maybe these character values are more important. But it's hard to understand that when you're a toddler and you're just observing other people running around buying groceries, you know, trying to impress each other in various ways and going to work and accumulating wealth. You don't really understand why they're doing those things. You just see them doing it. You think, my dad keeps going to work every day. He must think money's important. But maybe he just wants to protect his family, yeah, and look after his kids and things like that. You don't. It takes a while before you get to penetrate the deeper reasons why people are pursuing these external goals. So in other words, I'm suggesting that there are reasons why we all revert back to a very superficial understanding of human values, and generation after generation, we get caught in this trap. And then that's, to make it worse, there's another problem that adds to that, which is that it's exploited in marketing and also in political rhetoric, right? So we're sold celebrity culture, consumerist values and stuff like that by the society in which we live, because people want to sell us stuff, like, and make money out of us and things like that. So they take advantage of this weakness in our character that causes us to value things that are actually relatively superficial, right? I mean, money, Socrates argued that money seems like a good thing. I think we can all agree on that. Socrates would have admitted that money appears like it's a good thing to ancient Athenians as it does to modern Brits and Americans. But then he would say, well, what happens, you know, if you take a big pile of money and give it to someone that's wise and virtuous? I guess they could spend it on wise and virtuous stuff and do wise and virtuous things with it. Maybe they could be a great philanthropist or something. That'd be quite cool, right? But what would happen if you take the same pile of money and give it to somebody who's a vicious idiot, right? Who's foolish and greedy and corrupt? Wouldn't they just use that big pile of money to do foolish, greedy, corrupt things? Like, you know, so how does it really benefit them? It just allows them to do more bad stuff. So surely money in itself is neither good nor bad. But what matters is the use that you make of it and how you spend it. So then Socrates said, well, then the only thing that's really good is wisdom. Like a kind of moral or practical wisdom that allows you to use things well. Like, and the really bad thing is moral vice or ignorance, like, that causes people to use everything badly. The Stoics used to say, the wise man needs nothing but uses everything well, and the fool needs many things and uses all of them badly. Like, I think that really, in a way, kind of sums up the dilemma. That's one of the things I think that we can learn. But this ability to kind of to come back to your question, I haven't forgotten about it. Like, so we're screwed, right? Because not only are we innately, developmentally predisposed towards these superficial and unsatisfying values, generation after generation after generation, but there's also politicians and, you know, salesmen that are potentially exploiting, like, our greed and our fear, like, and our anger and our other baser instincts. You know, we get caught in a rat race. Like, we go out and get jobs and, you know, we buy stuff and all the stuff, like, that society expects you to do. until one day we start dying. And then you're lying on your deathbed, like Ebenezer Scrooge, right, looking at his grave, and you look back in your life and you think to yourself, I know I made $1 million, but I really wish, like, if I could turn back the clock, I would have made 2 million or 3 million. That would have been better. Or I wish I had more followers on social media. Like, if only I could get another few days extended of life, that's what I'd do. I'd run out and I'd get more Twitter followers, like, with it. Or probably more likely, as you're gazing into the eyes of the Grim Reaper, you think, shit, hang on a minute. Maybe some of the things I spent my life pursuing weren't really worth the effort. Or maybe some of it wasn't really all that important in retrospect. You know, maybe I got too hung up on status and what other people thought of me, you know. And maybe money serves a purpose, but it's not like the be-all and end-all. Maybe, in other words, like, it's when you come face-to-face with your own mortality, you start to fundamentally question the prevailing values of your society, like, in a radical way. Like, you snap out of the trance. It's like, you know, the Grim Reaper clicks his fingers to try to wake you up. Wake up! So they give you a shake, right? It's all an illusion. Like, but luckily, you don't actually have to die for that to happen. First of all, it's not unusual for people to have a brush with death. I think most people, by the time they reach 40 or 50, I hate to break it to you, but the majority of people have had at least one brush with death. I guess in retrospect, you know, like, I mean, it's hard to know whether you would describe this as good luck or bad luck, as the Stoics and Socrates often emphasize the setbacks and the misfortunes that we have in life often benefit us more. I look back at my life. When I was a young boy, I put myself in dangerous situations, and I believed that I was going to die 3, 4, 5 times, something like that. I thought I was going to drown at least 3 times, which I guess is unusual. It shows that I probably shouldn't be allowed anywhere near, like, the water anymore, right? But I look back in my life, there were times you might have medical scares. You might be in a dangerous situation. Some people maybe have dangerous jobs, like they're in the military or something, and there might be multiple times that they think they're going to die. You know, you might just be on a plane where there's a lot of turbulence, and you might, without any justification, or falsely think that you're going to die. But it doesn't matter, because psychologically, you still thought you were going to die, right? You might have heartburn and think you're having a heart attack. It doesn't matter. Like, you might still think you're going to die, and that might snap you out of the trance. It'd be weird to think I had heartburn and it snapped me out of the trance, made me question the prevailing values of my society. But it might. Right. But the thing is whether you come to terms with your own mortality or not. And the other thing that can make you do that, which is even more convenient in a sense, is if it's not you that dies, but somebody else. Like, so what's more likely to happen in some regards is that you're bereaved. Most people are, by the time you make it to 60 or 70, you'll have been bereaved multiple times. Probably your parents are dead. Like, maybe some of your friends have died along the way. So then it becomes, you know, are you learning from your experiences? Some people are insensitive and they don't learn from their experiences. And other people stop and think when their granddad dies. Like, some people, when their budgie dies, they might start to think about what's it all about. You know, the dog dies for some people. Or it might be friends that you lose along the way. You might stop and think, man, you know, like, what's life all about? Am I doing the right? Am I spending my time in the right way? Like, you know, we could drop dead at any minute. Like, we might not make it to the end of this podcast for all we know. Like, you know, but it's true. You know, Seneca used to say to himself every night when he went to bed, I might not wake up in the morning. You know, that's hardcore. Like, literally, be lying with his head on a pillow thinking, I might not wake up tomorrow. This might be it. This could be it, right? But coming to terms with your own mortality is one of the few things, I think, that potentially allows people to snap out of the trance of these superficial consumerist, materialist, celebrity culture, hedonistic, egotistical kind of pseudo values that we just acquire because it's what everyone else is doing. And it allows us to begin to really question things more deeply and maybe stand a better chance of identifying authentic core values, like that could allow us to live a more fulfilled life.
So we talked before very briefly around people looking for the simple lane to the complex problem. Mm-hmm. So what are your thoughts on angry young men ending up at Andrew Tate or Jordan Peterson?
It's a great question. There are a lot of angry... The first thing I'd say about it is that there was something... Look, if you want to exploit adolescent boys, right, the way to do it would be to try and imply to them that they're not manly enough, right, and that they need a father figure, and that they should be ashamed of their lack of manliness, right? That's the way to go. That's their weak spot. Right, if you want to exploit and manipulate adolescent boys, that's the weak point that you could potentially use as leverage against them. So it's not surprising that throughout history people have done that very thing. Right, the manosphere, or the worst aspects of it anyway, like, is not a new phenomenon. Like, people were doing it before the internet, but actually, you know, there were precursors of it, but it happens throughout history. In ancient Greece, the sophists mainly had, most of their students were adolescent boys. That was like they were the prime candidates for the sophists. And some of the sophists use language that seems very similar to modern influencers. Like, they go on and on about how real men are manly, how they should admire dictators, strong leaders, how justice or social virtue is a conspiracy of the weak to constrain the strong, like, and all this kind of stuff. So they should sneer at and look down on the slave morality, as Nietzsche calls it, of the masses. They lean towards oligarchy or dictatorship, as we would call it, rather than democracy for that reason, because they think of themselves as being superior to other people. And they believe that self-discipline and wisdom, as they call it, are more important virtues than justice or social virtue. So there's a lot of things that we find in people saying in the ancient world in order to brainwash or exploit vulnerable teenage boys that are insecure about their masculinity, that, surprise, surprise, like, finds parallels in the modern world, right? Because not that much has changed in that regard, right? The anger... if there were two things that I would say go together, like oil and water, right, don't combine very well at all in this regard, it would seem to me to be therapy or self-improvement or self-help more broadly on the one hand, and political rhetoric on the other hand. Those two things go together like oil and water, right? They don't mix well at all. Political rhetoric is all about exploiting people's baser instincts, encouraging simplistic thinking, sweeping generalizations, manipulating biases. Therapy and self-improvement are all about liberating ourselves from those biases and helping us to see beyond them. They're completely antagonistic forces. Maybe that's stating the obvious. I hope it is. But then it should be surprising that we find in the ancient world, the sophists, for example, combined political rhetoric and self-improvement. They claimed to be improving young men, but they were also experts on political rhetoric. And that we find this in the modern world. Like, it's accelerated a lot with the internet over the past 5 or 10 years. I mean, it always existed to some extent, but we see it kind of under a magnifying glass a bit now. It's odd that you get self-improvement influencers who go on and on and on about politics. These things do not combine very well at all. Like, hyping people up about politics often involves scapegoating, blaming other groups a lot. There is no psychotherapist who thinks that generally it's a good idea to make your clients more angry by encouraging them to blame outgroups or scapegoats for their problems. I'd have never known that as a therapy technique. Like, I mean, again, it seems like stating the obvious. It seems ridiculous. You know, when you say something, you think, to say this out loud, it sounds so absurd. It is difficult not to ridicule it. But it seems to me that that's what Jordan Peterson does for a living. Like, for the Daily Wire or whoever. You know, like, he's literally screaming down the camera at people about how, what is it, cultural Marxists, radical feminists, Canadians, or whoever, are communists and blah, 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 blah. And it's no coincidence that the comments on his videos and Andrew Tate's videos are really angry, right? Does consuming all this stuff make their followers more angry or less angry on social media? I'm going to say more angry. I don't know what other people think. That seems weird to me. It's meant to be self-improvement advice. Why is it making them all so much more angry? Generally, in therapy, we think it's a good idea to get people to take more ownership. So Jordan Peterson, for example, and Andrew Tate, all of these guys have the same advice, which is that people should take more responsibility. They should make their bed, tidy their room, bloody, bloody, blah. That's bogus advice, because what they then proceed to do is encourage people to disown responsibility for their emotions. So if you're angry, it's society's fault. It's the fault of radical feminists, cultural Marxists, Canadians, vegans, women in general, liberals, whatever. Like, you know, it's someone else's fault, that's for sure, that you're angry, right? And maybe you should go and take your anger and channel it into pumping something in the gym. Like, or, you know, you should suppress it. Or, you know, maybe you should channel it into righteous indignation and outrage and make videos shouting at people about the people that you're angry with, I guess. Or what we would normally do in cognitive therapy is say, like Socrates did 2,500 years ago, do other people feel as angry as you do about the same shit? And if the answer to that is, yeah, everybody feels as angry as I do about the same shit, then you've got a different level of problem. Like, you're now delusional, right? But if you think, no, some people aren't as outraged as I am about the same shit, like, there are varying responses, like, to the sort of shit that I'm really angry about. Jordan Peterson's example is, if a guy asks a girl out on a date and she rejects him, that it's natural for him to be consumed with rage. I mean, it's really surprising. He describes it as kind of even, you know, destructive rage. That surprised me. Like, that was news to me. Like, I thought, actually, that was kind of a weird response. Like, you know, I thought it would be pretty normal for most people to be kind of mildly offended and then maybe ask someone else out on a date. Like, that's the norm. Like, maybe up and cry in your beer for a couple of days and then move on or something like that. But not to be kind of violently outraged by it. That seems pathological to me rather than normal. But at the very least, like Socrates says, and Socrates questions young men, including his own son, about their anger using the Socratic method. Do other people, like, so do you not have a relative or an uncle, a friend that got rejected asking a girl out on a date and it was like water off a duck's back to the guy? Or it kind of got him in the feels and hurt his feelings, but he shrugged it off and moved on? Or like, he was really upset for, like, you know, a hot minute and then he moved on to something else? You know, like, are there not different ways of responding to this? Can some people not maybe learn from rejection rather than just being outraged by it? That's the first question. And then the second question is, if other people respond to the same shit in different ways, why is that? Is it genetics? Like, is it, you know, is it magic? Or is it because they think about it differently? They have different values and attitudes and assumptions or some people maybe have a feeling of an attitude of entitlement, like, or rigid demands that they impose on other people that make them violently enraged if they're rejected. You know, do other people have more flexible attitudes and perspectives, you know, and a better attitude towards their own coping that makes them less upset in those situations? So in cognitive therapy, we'd say, look, you know, spoiler alert, it's your thinking. Like, it's what's going on between your ears, right? I don't know if you've ever looked between your ears, but that's where the problem lies, right? There's stuff going on between your left ear and your right ear that's making you angry. And here's another spoiler alert. Going to the gym with Andrew Tate and pumping something isn't going to make a slight jot of difference to the opinions, beliefs, and attitudes that made you prone to anger in the first place, right? So venting anger does nothing to change the attitudes that made you get angry to begin with. How could it? Like, if you have an attitude of entitlement that makes you enraged when someone rejects you, how is going to the gym, like, inventing your anger going to do anything to change your entitlement? It isn't. It's just going to it's a band-aid, right? It's going to temporarily alleviate your nervous arousal, your energy. And then you're just going to get outraged again when the same thing happens in the future because you've learned nothing from the experience, because what's missing is a level of self-awareness that comes from noticing that other people don't respond in the same way as you and beginning to reflect on how your character, values, and attitudes might have contributed to the anger that you felt. So what happens in the manosphere is the opposite. I call it counter-therapy or anti-therapy, right? Because it makes people worse rather than better. Like, so rather than encouraging people to notice and acknowledge the variety of responses and take ownership for their thinking, people are encouraged to disown responsibility for their own emotions by attributing, we call this the attribution of the cause, right? So people are encouraged to, when people are angry, they don't think they need therapy. Anxious people buy lots of books on therapy. Euthydemus was probably anxious or depressed, right? He had loads of books on self-improvement. If you have loads of books on self-improvement, you might have some anxiety or depression. Because anxious and depressed people tend to blame themselves for their problems. They're introspective. But angry people do the opposite and externalize blame. So if I'm really angry, I would think it's you guys that need the therapy, not me, right? It's these radical feminists and cultural Marxists that should be in therapy, not me, right? They're in the wrong. They're the ones with the problem, right? And the more angry you get, the more you disown responsibility and externalize your problems, right? So making people angry towards other groups is pretty much counter-therapeutic. It's contrary to self-awareness, ownership for emotions, mindfulness. Angry people are not seen in therapy that often. They're underrepresented, unless they're there because they're depressed or anxious, and the anger is like a secondary part of that. Or they're in therapy because it's been mandated or they've been told to go by their wife, or they're in a prison, or they're in a school, or they're in the military, and they're told, hey, buddy, you need to go and see somebody about your anger problem. Like, you need to go and talk to someone about getting some anger management. That's when people end up doing anger management. But if they're on their own and they don't have a girlfriend or a wife, and they're isolated, and there's no one around them, there's no father figure to tell them, dude, you need to look in the mirror and have a word with yourself, then this massive, gargantuan, pus-filled blind spot of outrage that they have goes unnoticed by them. Like, and people that are isolated in that way will tend not to seek help for the problem. They're what I call therapy dodgers in a way, right? So they actually consume a lot of self-improvement stuff, but it's more about building confidence and increasing self-discipline, like tidy your room and stuff like that. Now, don't tidy your room, tidy your emotions, right? Do something about your anger and your antisocial behavior. Like, that's why you don't have a girlfriend, right? That's why you don't have any friends. That's why you don't have a job. That's why you're not married, right? It's your communication style and your anger problem. And that people naturally ignore, neglect anger as a problem. And the weird irony is that even when they're consuming, drinking from a veritable fire hose of self-help and self-improvement advice, often they're doing nothing about their anger. So people think, well, how can you say self-improvement is a bad thing? Or self-help is a bad thing? It would be like your shed's on fire and you're getting buckets of water and trying to put it out, doing self-help. And I say to you, I think this is a bad idea. And you're like, how can you tell me it's a bad idea? My shed's on fire. And I'd be like, turn around, your whole house is on fire. Like, you should be putting that out. Why the shed? So self-help that focuses on the wrong area, even if it feels like it's beneficial, in a sense is doing you more harm than good. As long as it diverts attention from your real problem, what we technically refer to as the real problem, like, which with those young guys is often, they'll go, I don't understand why I don't have a girlfriend. I don't know. Could it possibly be the constant and rage-fueled, behavior that you're engaged in that's putting people off? So the real problem goes unaddressed. And worse than that, like Tay and Peterson and these guys actually seem to encourage outrage and anger among their followers. So they're claiming to help them with other problems while fueling the real problem.
Donald, I've absolutely loved this conversation. The shed analogy, I think there's always something that I take from each conversation. I'm going to carry that with me. I could talk to you all day, and we had a long list of questions, and I feel like we've only scratched the surface, so we might need to get you back at some point. Donald, if people want to check you out and they want to read your books or they want to work with you, how can they get in touch?
Well, I'm pretty easy to find online, and you can buy my books from all good bookshops and even some bad ones. And my website is just donaldrobertson.name. Like, it's just my name and then .name instead of .com. But most of the stuff that I write is on Substack, actually. So if people ever use Substack, like, if they go on there, they can find all my articles and some podcasts that I do and stuff like that.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Donald.
Well, thank you, guys. Thanks to both of you. It's been a blast.
Thank you.